Hutter. Or possibly the other one, the ugly cop with the bushy white eyebrows, Daltrey. She could tell him where to find his lighter. The sound of Lou's voice made her feel a little weak, robbed her momentarily of her certainty. She felt she had never loved him the way he deserved, and that he had always loved her more than she deserved. "It's me," she said. "Are they listening?" "Aw, shit, Vic," Lou said. "What do you think?" Tabitha Hutter said, "I'm here, Vic," jumping onto the line and into the conversation. "You've got a lot of people here pretty upset. Do you want to talk about why you ran away?" "I went to go get my kid." "I know there are things you haven't told me. Maybe things you were afraid to tell me. But I need to hear them, Vic. Whatever you've been doing for the last 24 hours, I'm sure you think you had to do it. I'm sure you thought it was right." "24 hours? What do you mean, 24 hours? "That's how long we've been looking for you. You pulled one heck of a disappearing act. We'll have to talk about how you did that sometime. Why don't you tell me where..." "It's been 24 hours?" Vic cried again. The idea that she had lost a whole day seemed, in its own way, as incredible as a car that ran on human souls instead of unleaded. Hutter said quietly, patiently, "Vic, I want you to stay where you are." "I can't do that." "You have to." "No, shut up. Just listen. You need to locate a girl named Michelle Demeter. She lives in Brandenburg, Kentucky. Her father has been missing for a while. She's probably out of her mind with worry. He's here, downstairs, in the basement. He's dead. Been dead for a few days, I think. Do you have that?" "Yes, I..." "You treat him well, goddammit. Don't just stick him in a drawer in some fucking morgue. Get someone to sit with him until his daughter shows up. He's been alone long enough." "What happened to him?" "He was killed by a man named Bing Partridge. Bing was the guy in the gas mask who shot at me, the man you didn't think existed. He was working with Manx. I think they have a long history together." "Vic, Charlie Manx is dead." "No, he isn't. I saw him, and so did Nathan Demeter. Demeter will back up my story." "Vic," Tabitha said, "you just told me Nathan Demeter is dead. How is he going to back up your story? I want you to slow down. You've been through a lot. I think you've had a..." "I have not had a fucking break with reality. I have not been having imaginary conversations with a dead man. Demeter left a note, all right? A note naming Manx. Lou, are you still on the line?" "Yeah, Vic, I'm here. Are you okay?" "I talked to Wayne this morning, Lou. He's alive. He's still alive, and I'm going to get him back." "Oh, Jesus," he said, and his voice went rough with emotion, and she knew he was trying not to cry. "Oh, Jesus, what did he say?" "He hasn't been hurt," she said. "Victoria," Tabitha Hutter said, "when did you..." "Hang on," Lou cried. "Vic, dude, you can't do this alone. You can't cross this bridge alone." Vic readied herself, as if she were aiming a rifle on a distant target, and said, as calmly and clearly as she could manage, "Listen to me, Lou. I have to make one stop, and then I'm going to see a man who can get some anfo for me. With the right anfo, I can blow Manx's world right off the map." "What info?" Tabitha Hutter said. "Victoria, Lou is right. You can't deal with this on your own. Come in. Come in and talk to us. What man are you going to see? What is this information you need?" Lou's voice was slow and ragged with emotion. "Get out of there, Vic. We can horse shit around some other time. They're coming for you. Get out of there and go do what you have to do." "Mr. Carmody," Tabitha said. There was a sudden note of tension underlying her voice. "Mr. Carmody?" "I'm gone, Lou. I love you." "Back at ya," he said. He sounded choked with emotion, barely hanging on. She set the phone gently in its cradle. She thought he understood what she was telling him. He had said, "We can horseshit around some other time," a sentence that almost made sense in context. Almost, but not quite. There was a second meaning there, but no one besides Vic would have been able to detect it. Horseshit, a principal component of anfo, the substance her father had been using to blow up shelf rock for decades. She limped on her bad left leg to the sink and ran some cool water, splashed it onto her face and hands. Blood and grime circled the drain in pretty pink swirls. Vic had bits of gas mask man all over her, drops of liquefied Bing dripping down her shirt, splattered up her arms, probably in her hair. In the distance, she heard the wail of a police siren. The thought crossed her mind that she should have had a shower before calling Lou, or searched the house for a gun. She probably needed a gun more than she needed a shampoo. She pushed open the screen door and went carefully down the back steps, keeping the weight off her left knee. She would have to keep it extended while she rode. She had a bad moment, wondering how she would shift gears with the left foot, then remembered it was a British bike. Right. The gear shift was on the right side of the bike, a configuration that hadn't been legal in the United States since before she was born. Vic walked up the hill, face turned to the sun. She closed her eyes to concentrate her senses on the good warmth against her skin. The sound of the siren grew louder and louder behind her, the Doppler effect causing the shriek to rise and fall, swell and collapse. Tabitha Hutter would lop off heads when she found out they had approached the house with their sirens blaring, giving Vic plenty of advance notice that they were coming. At the top of the hill, as she lurched into the parking lot of the New American Faith Tabernacle, she looked back and saw a police car swerving onto Block Lane, sliding to a stop in front of Bing's house. The cop didn't even swing into the driveway, just slewed to a halt with the car at an angle, blocking half the road. The cop behind the wheel flung himself out so quickly, his head bumped the doorframe and his hat was knocked into the road. He was so young. Vic couldn't imagine dating him, let alone being arrested by him. She continued on, and in three more steps could no longer see the house below. She had a moment to wonder what she would do if her bike wasn't there, if some kids had discovered it with the keys in the ignition and taken it for a ride. But the Triumph was right where she had left it, tilted over on its rusted kickstand. It wasn't easy to stand it up. Vic made a small, sobbing sound of pain, pushing with her left leg to straighten it. She turned the key over, flipped the switch to run, and stomped on the gas. The bike had been rained on and sat out all night, and it would have been no surprise to her if it didn't want to start. But the Triumph boomed right away, seemed almost impatient to go. "I'm glad one of us is ready," she said. She turned it in a circle and rolled it out of the shadows. She took it around the ruin of the church, and as she glided along, it began to rain. Water fell glittering and brilliant from the sunlit sky, raindrops as cold as October. It felt good on her skin, in her dry, bloody, dirty hair. "Rain, rain," she said softly. "Come again and wash this mess away." The Triumph and the woman upon it inscribed a great hoop around the charred sticks that had once been a house of worship. When she had returned to the place where she started, the bridge was there, set back in the woods, just as it had been the day before. Only it had turned itself around, so as she drove onto it, she entered from what she thought of as the eastern side. There was green spray paint on the wall to her left. "Here," it said. She rolled onto the old rotten boards. Planks rattled beneath her tires. As the sound of the engine faded in the distance, a crow landed at the entrance to the bridge and stared into its dark mouth. When the bridge disappeared 2 minutes later, it went all at once, popped out of existence like a balloon pricked by a pin. It even banged like a balloon and emitted a clear, shimmering shockwave that hit the crow like a speeding car, blew off half its feathers, and threw it 20 feet. It was dead by the time it hit the ground. Just another piece of roadkill. Laconia, New Hampshire. Hutter saw it before anyone else did, even though it was happening right in front of all of them. Lou Carmody began to go down. His right knee buckled, and he put a hand against the big oval table in the conference room. "Mr. Carmody," she said. He sank into one of the rolling office chairs, fell into it with a soft crash. His color had changed, his big grizzled face taking on a milky pallor, a sweat shining greasily on his forehead. He put one wrist to his brow as if feeling for a fever. "Mr. Carmody," Hutter said again, calling down the table and across the room to him. There were men all around him. Hutter didn't understand how they could stand there and not see that the guy was having a heart attack. "I'm gone, Lou," Vic McQueen said, her voice coming through the Bluetooth headset in Hutter's ear. "I love you." "Back at ya," Carmody said. He wore a headpiece identical to Tabitha Hutter's own. Almost everyone in the room was wearing one, the whole team listening in on the conversation. They were in a conference room at the state police headquarters outside Laconia. It could have been the conference room at a Hilton, or a Courtyard Marriott, a big bland space with a long oval central table and windows looking out in an expanse of parking lot. McQueen hung up. Hutter tore out her earpiece. Cundy, her lead tech, was on his laptop looking at Google Maps. It was zoomed in on Sugar Creek, Pennsylvania, to show Block Lane. Cundy rolled his eyes up to look at Hutter. "We'll have cars there in 3 minutes, maybe less. I just spoke with the locals, and they're on the way with sirens blasting." Hutter opened her mouth, meant to say, "Tell them to turn their fucking sirens off." You didn't warn a federal fugitive that the cops were closing in. That was fundamental. But then Lou Carmody leaned all the way forward, so his face was resting on the table, his nose squashed to the wood. He grunted softly and clutched at the tabletop, as if he were at sea and clinging to a great chunk of driftwood. And so what Hutter said instead was, "Ambulance, now."
"You want an ambulance to go to Block Lane?" Cundy asked.
"No, I want an ambulance to come here," she said, moving swiftly away from him and around the table. She raised her voice. "Gentlemen, give Mr. Carmody some air, please. Step back, please." Lou Carmody's office chair had been slowly rolling backward, and at that exact moment it slid out from beneath him and Carmody went straight down, as if dropped through a trap door. Daltrey was the closest to him, standing just behind the chair with a mug that said, "World's Best Granddad." He leaped aside and slopped black coffee down his pink shirt.
"The fuck hit him?" Daltrey asked.
Hutter went down on one knee next to Carmody, who was half under the table. She put her hands on one big sloping shoulder and pushed. It was like trying to flip a mattress. He slumped onto his back, his right hand grabbing his Iron Man t-shirt, twisting it into a knot between his man tits. His cheeks were loose, and his lips were gray. He let out a long, ragged gasp. His gaze darted here and there, as if he were trying to get his bearings. "Stay with us, Lou," she said. "Help will be here soon." She snapped her fingers, and his gaze found her at last. He blinked and smiled uncertainly.
"I like your earrings. Supergirl. I would have never figured you for Supergirl."
"No? Who would you have figured me for?" she asked, just trying to keep him talking. Her fingers closed on his wrist. There was nothing for a long moment, and then his pulse whapped, a single big kick, and then another stillness, and then a flurry of rapid beats.
"Velma," he said. "You know, from Scooby-Doo."
"Why, because we're both dumpy?" Hutter asked.
"No," he said, "because you're both smart."
"I'm scared. Will you hold my hand?" She took his hand in hers. He gently moved his thumb back and forth over her knuckles.
"I know you don't believe anything Vic told you about Manx," he said to her in a sudden fierce whisper. "I know you think she's out of her mind. You can't let facts get in the way of the truth."
"Jinkies," she said. "What's the difference?" He surprised her by laughing, a rapid, helpless, panting sound. She had to ride to the hospital with him in the ambulance. He wouldn't let go of her hand. Here, Iowa. By the time Vic came out of the other end of the bridge, she had slowed to almost nothing and the bike was in neutral. She remembered acutely her last visit to the Here Public Library, how she had rushed headlong into a curb and been flung for a knee-scraping slide across a concrete path. She didn't think she could take a crash in the state she was in now. The bike didn't care for neutral, though, and as it thumped down onto the asphalt road that ran behind the library, the engine died with a thin, dispirited wheeze. When Vic had last been here, the strip of park behind the library had been raked and clean and shady, a place to throw down a blanket and read a book. Now it was half an acre of mud, gouged with tread marks from loaders and dump trucks. The century-old oaks and birch had been plucked from the ground and bulldozed into a 12-foot-high mound of dead wood off to one side. A single park bench remained. Once it had been dark green, with wrought-iron arms and legs, but the paint had peeled and the wood beneath was splintery, sun-baked almost to colorlessness.
Maggie dozed upright, chin on chest, in one corner of the bench, in the direct, unforgiving light of day. She held a carton of lemonade in one hand, a fly buzzing around its mouth. Her sleeveless t-shirt exposed scrawny, withered arms, spotted with the scars from dozens of cigarette burns. She had at some point blasted her hair with fluorescent orange dye, but the brown and gray roots were showing. Vic's own mother had not looked so old when she died. The sight of Maggie, so worn, so emaciated, so ill-used, and so alone, hurt Vic more sharply than the ache in her left knee. She forced herself to remember, in careful detail, how in a moment of anger and panic she had thrown papers in this woman's face, had threatened her with police. Her sense of shame was exquisite, but she did not allow herself to shove it aside. She let it burn, the tip of a cigarette held firmly against skin. The front brake shrilled as Vic settled to a stop. Maggie lifted her head, pushed some of her brittle-looking sherbet hair back from her eyes, and smiled sleepily. Vic put the kickstand down. Maggie's smile vanished as quickly as it had come. She rose unsteadily to her feet. Oh, Vic! What did you do to yourself? You've got blood all over you. If it makes you feel better, most of it isn't mine. It doesn't. Makes me feel faint. Didn't I have to put band-aids on you last time you were here? Yeah. I guess you did, Vic said. She looked past Maggie at the library. The first floor windows were covered over with plywood sheeting. The iron door at the rear was crisscrossed with yellow police tape. What happened to your library, Maggie? She's seen better days, like me, Maggie said, and grinned to show her missing teeth. Oh, Maggie, Vic said. And for an instant she felt very close to crying again. It was Maggie's uneven grape-soda-colored lipstick. It was the dead trees in a pile. It was the sun, too hot and too bright. Maggie deserved some shade to sit in. I don't know which one of us needs a doctor more. Oh, gosh, I'm okay. Just my stammer is worse. And your arms. Maggie looked down at them, squinting in puzzlement at the constellation of burns, then looked back up. It helps me talk normal. Helps me with other stuff, too. What helps you? Pain. Come on, let's go in. Mama Maggie will fix you up. I need something besides fixing Maggie. I have questions for your tiles. Might not have answers, Maggie said, turning up the path. They don't work so well anymore. They stammer too now, but I'll try after we get you cleaned up and I'm a mother you some. I don't know if I have time for mothering. Sure you do, Maggie said. He hasn't made it to Christmas land yet. We both know you can't catch him before then. Be like trying to grab a handful of fog. Vic gingerly descended from the bike. She was almost hopping to keep the weight off her left leg. Maggie put an arm around her waist. Vic wanted to tell her she didn't need a crutch, but the truth was she did. She doubted she could make it to the back of the library without help, and her arm went automatically over Maggie's shoulders. They walked a step or two, and then Maggie paused, twisting her head to look back at the shorter way, which once again spanned the Cedar River. The river seemed wider than Vic remembered, the water boiling right up to the edge of the narrow road that looped behind the library. The thicket-covered embankment that had once lined the water had been washed away. What's on the other end of the bridge this time? Couple of dead people. Will anyone follow you through? I don't think so. There are police looking for me back there, but the bridge will pop out of existence before they find it. There were police here. Looking for me? I don't know. Maybe. I was coming back from the drugstore and saw him parked out front, so I took off. I stay here sometimes other places. Where? I think the first time we met you said something about living with relatives, an uncle or something. Maggie shook her head. He's gone. Whole trailer park is gone. Washed away. The two women limped toward the back door. They're probably looking for you because I called you. They might be tracking your cell phone, Vic said. thought of that. Dumped it after you called. I knew you wouldn't need to call again to find me. No worries.
The yellow tape across the rusting iron door read Danger. A sheet of paper slipped inside a clear plastic envelope and stuck to the door, identified the structure as unsound. The door was not locked, but held ajar by a chunk of concrete. Maggie ducked the tape and pushed it inward. Vic followed her into darkness and ruin. The stacks had once been a vast, cavernous vault that smelled fragrantly of 10,000 books, aging gently in the shadows. The shelves were still there, although banks of them had been toppled like 12-foot-tall iron dominoes. Most of the books were gone, although some remained in rotting heaps scattered here and there, stinking of mildew and decay. "The big flood was in 2008, and the walls are still wet." Vic brushed one hand against the cold, moist concrete and found that it was true. Maggie held her as they picked their way carefully through the debris. Vic kicked a pile of beer cans. As her eyes adjusted to the gloom, she saw that the walls had been tagged with graffiti, the usual assortment of 6-foot cocks and dinner plate proportioned tits. But there was also a grand message, scrawled in dripping red paint. "Please be quiet in the library, people are trying to get high." "I'm sorry, Maggie," Vic said. "I know you love this place. Is there anyone doing anything to help out? Were the books moved to a new location?"
"You bet," Maggie said.
"Nearby?"
"Pretty close. The town dump is just a mile downriver."
"Couldn't someone do something for the old place?" Vic said. "What is it, 100 years old? It must be a historical site."
"You got that right," Maggie said, and for an instant there was no trace of a stammer in her voice at all. "It's history, baby."
Vic caught a glimpse of her expression in the shadows. It was true. Pain really did help Maggie with her stammer. The Library. Maggie Lee's office behind the fish tank was still there, in a manner of speaking. The tank was empty, with filthy Scrabble tiles heaped in the bottom, the cloudy glass walls giving a view of what had once been the children's library. Maggie's gunmetal desk remained, although the surface had been gouged and scratched and someone had spray-painted a gaping red vulva on one side. An unlit candle bent over a pool of violet wax. Maggie's paperweight, Chekhov's gun, and yes, Vic got the joke now, held her place in the hardcover she was reading, Ficciones by Borges. There was a tweed couch that Vic didn't remember. It was a yard sale number, some rents in it patched with duct tape and some holes not patched at all, but at least it wasn't damp, didn't stink of mildew.
"What happened to your koi?" Vic asked.
"I'm not sure. I think someone ate it," Maggie said. "I hope it made someone a good meal. No one should go hungry." There were syringes and rubber tubing on the floor. Vic was careful not to step on any needles as she made her way to the couch and lowered herself upon it.
"Those aren't mine,
Maggie said, nodding to the syringes, and she went for the broom that was leaning in a corner where once there had been a coat rack. The broom itself doubled as the coat rack now. Maggie's filthy old fedora hung upon it.
"I haven't shot up since last year. Too expensive. I don't know how anyone can afford to get high in this economy."
Maggie set her hat on her sherbet-colored hair with the dignity and care of a drunk dandy about to sway out of the absinthe hall and into the rainy Paris night. She took up her broom and swept. The syringes clattered in a glassy sort of way across the cement.
"I can wrap your leg and give you some oxy," Maggie said. "Way cheaper than heroin."
She bent to her desk, found a key, unlocked the bottom drawer. She reached in and removed an orange pill bottle, a carton of cigarettes, and a rotting purple Scrabble bag.
"Sobriety is even cheaper than OxyContin," Vic said.
Maggie shrugged and said, "I only take as needed." She poked a cigarette into the corner of her mouth, lit a match with her thumbnail. A good trick.
"When is it needed?"
"It's a painkiller. I take it to kill pain." She drew smoke, put the lighter down.
"That's all. What happened to you, Vic?"
Vic settled back into the couch, head on the armrest.
She could not bend her left knee all the way or unbend it, could hardly bear to move it. She could hardly bear to look at it. It was twice the size of the other knee, a purple and brown map of bruises. She began to talk, telling about the last 2 days as best as she could remember, getting things out of order, providing explanations that seemed more confusing than the things they were meant to explain. Maggie did not interrupt or ask for clarification. A faucet ran for half a minute, then stopped. Vic let out a sharp, pained breath when Maggie put a cold, damp washcloth against her left knee and gently held it there. Maggie opened her medicine bottle and shook out a little white pill. Fragrant blue smoke unspooled from her cigarette, draped her like the ghost of a scarf. "I can't take that," Vic said. "Sure you can. You don't have to dry swallow them. I've got lemonade. It's a little warm, but pretty tasty." "No, I mean it'll put me to sleep. I've slept too much already. On a concrete floor? After you were gassed? That isn't sleep." She gave Vic the tablet of OxyContin. "That's unconsciousness. Maybe after we talk. If I try to help you find out what you want to know, do you promise you won't ride off till you rest?" Vic reached for the other woman's hand and squeezed it. "I do." Maggie smiled and patted Vic's knuckles, but Vic did not let go of her. She said, "Thank you, Maggie, for everything, for trying to warn me, for helping me. I'd give anything to take back the way I acted when I saw you in Haverhill. I was scared of you." "That's not an excuse. There isn't any excuse. There's a lot of things I wish I could redo. You can't imagine. I wish there was something I could do to show you how sorry I am. Something I could give you besides words." Maggie's whole face lit up. A child seeing a kite lift into the blue, blue sky. "Oh, darn, Vic, you're gonna make me cry. What's better in the whole world than words? Besides, you're already doing something," Maggie said. "You're here. It's so nice to have someone to talk to. Not that it's much fun to talk to me." "Shh, you shush with that. Your stammer doesn't bother me half as much as it bothers you," Vic said. "The first time we met, you told me that your Scrabble tiles and my bike were both knives for cutting through the stitches between reality and thought. You had that right. That's not the only thing they can cut. They wound up cutting both of us good. I know that my bridge, the shorter way, damaged me. In here." She reached up and tapped her left temple. "I traveled across it a few times too many, and it put my mind out of joint. I've never been right. I burned down my home. I burned down my life. I ran away from both of the boys I loved because I was scared of damaging them or not being enough for them. That's what my knife did to me. And you've got this thing with your speech. It's like I managed to cut out my own tongue with my knife. Seems like the only one who never winds up bleeding from using his psychic knife is Manx." "Oh, no. Oh, no, Vic. Manx has had it worst. He's been bled completely dry." Maggie lowered her eyelids, drawing a deep, luxurious lungful of smoke. The tip of her cigarette throbbed in the darkness. She removed the cigarette from her mouth, looked at it thoughtfully for a moment, and then stabbed it into her own bare thigh through one of the tears in her jeans. "Jesus!" Vic shouted. She sat up so quickly that the room lurched hard in one direction and her stomach lurched hard in the other. She fell back against the armrest, overcome by dizziness. "For the best," Maggie said through clenched teeth. "I want to be able to talk to you, not just spray you with spit." The breath spurted out of her in short, pained exhalations. "It's the only way I can get my tiles to say anything anyhow, and sometimes even that isn't enough. Was necessary. What were we saying?" "Oh, Maggie," Vic said, "don't make a big deal. Let's get to it or I'll have to do that again, and the more I do it, the less well it works." "You said Manx is bled dry." "That's right. The wraith makes him young and strong. It preserves him. But it's cost him his ability to feel regret or empathy. That's what his knife cut out of him. His humanity." "Yeah, except it's going to cut the same thing out of my son, too. The car changes the children Manx takes with him on his trips to Christmasland. It turns them into fucking vampires or something, doesn't it?" "Close enough," Maggie said. She rocked back and forth, eyes shut against the pain in her leg. "Christmasland is an inscape, right? A place Manx invented out of thought. A make-believe place. Oh, it's a real place. Ideas are as real as rocks. Your bridge is real, too, you know. It isn't actually a covered bridge, of course. The rafters, the roof, the boards under your tires. They're stage dressing for something more basic. When you left the gas mask man's house and came here, you didn't cross a bridge. You crossed an idea that looked like a bridge. And when Manx gets to Christmasland, he'll be arriving in an idea of happiness that looks like, I don't know, Santa Claus's workshop? I think it's an amusement park. Amusement park. That sounds about right. Manx doesn't have happiness anymore. Only amusement. It's an idea of endless fun, endless youth, dressed up in a form his dumb little mind can understand. His vehicle is the instrument that opens the way. Suffering and unhappiness provide the energy to run the car and open his passage to that place. This is also why he has to take the kids with him. The car needs something he no longer has. He drains unhappiness from the children just like a B-movie vampire sucking blood. And when he uses them up, they're monsters. They're still children, I think. They're just children who can't understand anything except fun. They've been remade into Manx's idea of childhood perfection. He wants kids to be forever innocent. Innocence ain't all it's cracked up to be, you know. Innocent little kids rip the wings off flies because they don't know any better. That's innocence. The car takes what Manx needs and changes his passengers so they can live in his world of thought. It sharpens their teeth and robs them of their need for warmth. A world of pure thought would be pretty cold, I bet. Now, take your pill, Vic. You need to rest and get your strength back before you ride out of here to face him again. She held out her palm with a tablet in it. Maybe I could use something. Not just for my knee, for my head, Vic told her, and then winced at a fresh stab of pain in her left eyeball. I wonder why I always feel it behind my left eye whenever I use my bridge. Been like that since childhood. She laughed shakily. I wept blood once, you know. Maggie said, creative ideas form in the right side of the brain. But did you know the right side of your brain sees out from your left eye? And it must take a lot of energy to shove a thought out of your head and into the real world. All that energy zapping you right, she pointed at Vic's left eye, there. Vic looked longingly at the pill. Still, she hesitated. You are going to answer my questions, yes? With your tiles. You haven't asked anything I need them for yet. I need to know how to kill him. He died in prison, but it didn't stick. You already know the answer to that one, I think. Vic took the OxyContin from Maggie's hand and accepted the carton of lemonade when she offered it. The juice was warm and sticky and sweet and good. She knocked the Oxy down on the first swallow. The pill left a faint, bitter aftertaste. The car, Vic said. The Wraith. Yeah. When the car fell apart, he fell apart. At some point, someone probably yanked the engine right out of it and he dropped dead at last. But then the engine was put back and the car was fixed up, and there you go. As long as the car is roadworthy, so is he. So if I destroy the car, I destroy him. Maggie took a long suck on her cigarette. The tip of it was the brightest thing in the dark. Bet on it. Okay, Vic said. It had only been a minute or two, but the pill was already starting to kick in. When she closed her eyes, she felt as if she were gliding soundlessly on her old tough burner, moving through a dim and shady forest. Vic, Maggie said gently, and Vic pulled her head up off the armrest and blinked rapidly, realized she had been just a moment from dozing off. Some pill, she said. What do you need to ask my tiles? Maggie prodded. You better get to it while you still can. My kid. I'm going to have to go to Christmasland to get him. They'll be there tonight, I think, or early tomorrow morning, and I'm going to be there, too. But by then, Wayne will be different. I could hear it in his voice when I talked to him. He's fighting it, but the car is making him into one of those fucking things. Can I fix him? I need to know that. If I get him back, is there some way to cure him? I don't know. No child has ever come back from Christmasland. So ask. Your bag of letters can tell you that, can't it? Maggie slid off the edge of the couch onto the floor. She gave the moth-eaten sack a gentle shake. The tiles clicked and rattled within. "Let's see what we can see," she said, and plunged a hand inside. She trowled about, came up with a fistful of tiles, and dropped them on the floor. XOXOXOXXO. Maggie stared at them with a look of weary dismay. "This is all I get most days. Hugs and kisses for the lonely, stammering girl." Maggie swept one hand across the floor, grabbing the letters and jamming them back into the bag. "Okay, it's okay. It was worth a try. You can't know everything. You can't find out everything." "No," Maggie said. "When you come to a library to find something out, you should get what you want." She dug around in her faux velvet pouch and came up with another fistful of tiles, threw them at the floor. P-P-P-P-P-P-P-P. "Don't stick your tongue out at me," she said to her letters. She snatched up the tiles, dropped them in the bag, then shoved her hand in the Scrabble purse once again. This time her arm disappeared almost to the elbow, and Vic heard what sounded like hundreds of tiles grinding and clattering around. Maggie came up with another fistful, let them fall. F-U, 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 F-U. "Fuck me? Fuck me!" Maggie cried. "Throw my earrings back in my face? F-f-f-fuck you!" She plucked her cigarette out of her mouth, but before she could sink it into her own arm, Vic sat up, caught her wrist. "Don't," Vic said. The room swooped this way and that, as if Vic were sitting in a swing. Still, she had Maggie's arm. Maggie stared up at her, her eyes bright and their sunken hollows, bright and frightened and exhausted. "We'll get it another time, Maggie. Maybe I'm not the only one who needs some rest. You were in Massachusetts a week and a half ago. You came back by bus the whole way?" "I hitched some," Maggie said. "When's the last time you ate?" "Well, yesterday I had a sandwich from And like that she went mute. Her face darkened from red to a deep, grotesque shade of violet, as if she were strangling. Spit foamed at the corners of her lips. "Shh," Vic said. "Shh. Okay. So we'll get you something to eat." Maggie exhaled smoke, glanced around for a place to extinguish her cigarette, and then put it out in the far armrest. It hissed, and a black coil of smoke drifted toward the ceiling. "After your nap, Vic." Vic nodded, slumping backward. She didn't have it in her to wrangle with Maggie. "I'll nap and you'll nap," Vic said. "And then we'll get you some food, get you some clothes. Save Wayne, save the library, make things better, do it all. Wonder Twin powers activate. Lie down." "Okay, you take the couch. I've got a nice old blanket. I can just stretch out on the floor. With me, Maggie. There's room on the couch for us both." Vic was awake but seemed to have lost the ability to force her eyes open again. "You wouldn't mind?" "No, sweetheart," Vic said, as if she were speaking to her son. Maggie slipped onto the couch beside her and pressed herself to Vic's side, her bony hip against Vic's, her bony elbow across Vic's stomach. "Will you hold me, Vic?" Maggie asked in a tremulous voice. "It's been a long time since anyone nice helped me. I mean, I know you're not into girls since you have a kid and all, but..." Vic put her arm around Maggie's waist and held the thin, shivering woman against her. "You can shut up now, you know," Vic said. "Oh," Maggie said. "Oh, okay. That's a relief." Laconia. They wouldn't let Lou walk anywhere, didn't want to take a chance that the fat man might get dizzy and fall onto his face. So after his examination, he sat in a wheelchair and a man nurse wheeled him to recovery. The man-nurse was his age and had sleepy eyes with dark circles under them and a jutting Cro-Magnon forehead. His name tag said, improbably, Bilbo. He had a spaceship tattooed on one hairy forearm, Serenity from the TV show Firefly. "I am a leaf on the wind," Lou said, and the man-nurse said, "Dude, don't say that. I don't want to start crying on the job." The detective followed, carrying Lou's clothes in a paper bag. Lou didn't like the way the guy smelled of nicotine and menthol. but mostly of nicotine, and he didn't like the way the guy seemed too small for his clothes, so everything sagged. His shirt, his clam-colored trousers, his shabby jacket. Daltrey asked, "What are you two talking about?" "Firefly," the man-nurse said, without looking back. "We're browncoats." "What's that mean? You two gonna gay marry?" Daltrey asked and laughed at his own joke. Bilbo, the man-nurse, said, "Jesus, go back to the 50s, dude." But he didn't say it loud enough for Daltrey to hear. Recovery was a single big room containing two rows of beds, each bed parked in its own little compartment defined by pale green curtains. Bilbo wheeled Lou almost to the far end of the room before turning toward an empty bed on the right. "You're sweet, monsieur," Bilbo said. Lou heaved himself up onto the mattress while Bilbo hung a bright sack of fluid from the stainless steel rack standing alongside. Lou still had the intravenous cannula taped to his right arm, and Bilbo plugged it into the drip. Lou felt the fluid right away, a strong, icy stream that measurably dropped the whole temperature of his body.
"Should I be afraid?" Lou asked.
"Of an angioplasty? No. On the scale of medical complexity, it's only slightly trickier than having your wisdom teeth removed. Just have the surgery. No fear."
"Uh-uh," Lou said. "I'm not talking about the angioplasty. I mean the stuff you're pumping into me. What is it? Something serious?"
"Oh, this is nothing. You're not going under the knife today, so you don't get the good shit. This is the blood-thinning agent. Also, it'll mellow you out. Got to keep the mellows going."
"It'll put me to sleep?"
"Faster than a marathon of Dr. Quinn, medicine woman." Daltrey dropped a paper bag into the chair next to the bed. Lou's clothes were in there, folded up and stacked in a pile, his boxers on top, big as a pillowcase.
"How long has he got to be here?" Daltrey asked.
"We'll hold him for observation overnight."
"That's not real good goddamn timing."
"Artery stenosis is famously inconvenient," Bilbo said. "It never calls in advance, just drops in to party whenever it feels like it." Daltrey slipped his cell phone out of his pocket.
"You can't use that here."
Daltrey said, "Where can I use it?"
"You'd have to walk back through the emergency room and go outside."
Daltrey nodded, gave Lou a slow, disapproving look.
"Don't go anywhere, Mr. Carmody."
He turned and started down the length of the room. "And he paddled away in his douche canoe," Bilbo said.
"What if I need to make a call?" Lou said. "Can I make a call before I go Betty-bye? My son, man. Have you heard about my son? I need to call my parents. They're not going to be able to sleep tonight until I let them know what's happening."
A lie. If he got his mother on the phone and started telling her about Wayne, she would have no idea who he was talking about. She was in assisted living and only capable of recognizing Lou himself one day out of three. It would be even more surprising if his father were interested in the latest news. He had been dead for 4 years.
"I can snag you a phone," Bilbo said. "Something we can plug in next to the bed. Just try and relax. I'll be back in 5.
He stepped away from the bed, drew the curtain shut, and walked away. Lou didn't wait, and he didn't think about it. He was the kid on the motorcycle again, hauling skinny Vic McQueen up onto the seat behind him, feeling her trembling arms around his waist. He threw his legs over the side of the cot and jerked the cannula out of his arm. A fat BB of blood swelled up from the needle hole. As soon as he heard Vic's voice over the earpiece, he'd felt the blood rushing to his head, had felt his pulse banging in his temples. His head had started to get heavy, as if his skull were full of liquid metal instead of brain tissue. What was worse, though, was that the room began to move in his peripheral vision. That sensation of the world beginning to rotate around him made him motion sick, and he had to stare directly down at the table to block it out. But then his head got so heavy he tilted over and kicked his chair out from under him.
"It wasn't a heart attack, was it?"
he asked the doctor while she listened to his throat with her stethoscope.
"Because if it was a heart attack, it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be."
"No, not a heart attack. But you may have suffered from a transient ischemic attack," she said. A pretty black woman with a smooth, dark, ageless face.
"Yeah," Lou told her. "I figured it was either a heart attack or a transient schematic attack. Transient schematic attack was my second choice."
"Ischemic. It's a kind of mini-stroke. I'm hearing a hollow whoosh in your carotid artery.
Ah, that's what you were listening to. I was just about to tell you, I think my heart is lower.
She smiled. She looked like she wanted to pinch his cheek and give him a cookie. What I'm hearing is serious plaque buildup.
Seriously? I brush twice a day.
Different kind of plaque. In your blood. Too much bacon. She patted his belly. Too much butter on your popcorn. You'll have to have an angioplasty, possibly a stent. If you don't receive one, you could suffer a major, even fatal stroke.
I've been ordering salads when I go to McDonald's, he told her,
and was surprised to feel tears stinging at the backs of his eyes. He was nonsensically relieved that the cute little FBI agent wasn't around to see him crying again. Now Lou grabbed the brown paper bag in the chair and wiggled into his underwear and jeans, pulling them on under his hospital johnny. He had passed out after talking to Vic. The world had gone greasy and slick, and he couldn't hold on to it. It squirted right out of his fingers. But up until the moment he passed out, he was listening to her. He understood, just from the pitch of her voice, that she wanted him to do something, that she was trying to tell him something. I have to make one stop, and then I'm going to go see a man who can get some anfo for me. With the right anfo, I can blow Manx's world right off the map. Tabitha Hutter and all the other cops who were listening in on the call heard what Vic wanted them to hear. They heard info instead of anfo. It was like one of Vic's search engine pictures, only a picture made of sound instead of color. You didn't notice what was right in front of you because you didn't know how to look, or in this case, listen. But Lou had always known how to listen to her. Lou yanked off his johnny, pulled on his shirt. Anfo. Her father was the man who blew things up, took out ledge rock, tree stumps, and old pilings with anfo, and who had blown Vic off without a look back. He had not ever even held Wayne, and Vic had talked to him perhaps only a dozen times in a dozen years. Lou had spoken with him more often, had sent him photos and video of Wayne by way of email. He knew from things Vic had told him that the man was a wife-beater and a cheat. He knew, too, from things Vic had not told him, that she missed him and loved him with an intensity perhaps matched only by what she felt for her son. Lou had never met the man, but knew where he lived, knew his number, and knew that Vic was going to see him. Lou would be waiting when she got there. She wanted him there, or she wouldn't have told him. He stuck his head out through the curtain, looked down an aisle made by rows of hanging sheets. He saw a doctor and a nurse, a female nurse, not Bilbo, standing together, running down items on a clipboard, but their backs were turned to him. Lou carried his sneakers in one hand, slipped into the aisle, turned right, and pushed through a pair of swinging doors into a wide, white hallway. He wound his way through the building, moving in a direction that felt like it would take him away from the emergency room entrance. He tugged his Vans on as he went. The lobby ceiling was 50 feet high and had big slabs of pink crystal hanging from it, giving it a fortress of solitude vibe. Water splashed in a black slate fountain. Voices echoed. The smell of coffee and muffins wafting from a Dunkin' Donuts made his stomach clutch with hunger. The thought of eating a sugared jelly donut was like imagining putting the barrel of a loaded gun in his mouth. I don't need to live forever, he thought. Just please, for however long it takes me to get my son back. A pair of nuns were getting out of a cab, right out in front of the revolving door. That was damn close to divine intervention as far as Lou was concerned. He held the door for them, then climbed into the back seat. The rear of the cab sank on its springs. Where are we going? The cabbie said. To jail, Lou thought. But what he said was, train station. Bilbo Prince watched the cab lurch away from the curb in a gush of filthy blue exhaust, noted the number and the license plate, then turned and walked away. He drifted down halls, upstairs, downstairs, and exited at last through the ER entrance on the opposite side of the hospital. The old cop, Daltrey, waited there, having himself a smoke. He took off, Bilbo said, like you said he would. Caught a cab outside the lobby. You get the cab number? And the license, Bilbo said, and told him both. Daltrey nodded and opened his cell phone. He pressed a single button and put it to his ear, then half turned away from Bilbo. Yep, he's moving, he said to whoever was on the other end of the line. Hutter says just watch him, so we watch him.
See where he goes and be ready to step in if the fat bastard starts to vapor lock again.
Daltrey hung up, pitched his smoke, and started moving away into the parking lot.
Bilbo trotted after him and tapped his shoulder.
The old guy looked back.
His brow furrowed and his expression suggested he recognized Bilbo, but already couldn't quite remember who he was or how they knew each other.
"That it, man?" Bilbo said. "Where's the love?"
Oh, right.
Daltrey dug around in his pocket and came up with a $10 bill and stuck it in Bilbo's hand.
"There you go. Live long and prosper. Isn't that what you Trekkers say?"
Bilbo looked from the grimy $10 bill, he'd been expecting at least a 20, to the tattoo of serenity on his hairy arm.
"Yeah, I guess. But I'm not a Star Trek fan. My tattoo here? This is serenity, not the Enterprise. I'm a brown coat, man."
"More like turncoat," Daltrey said, and laughed.
Flecks of spittle hit Bilbo in the face.
Bilbo wanted to throw the $10 at his feet and walk away, show the ugly loudmouth fuck what he thought of his money. But then he reconsidered and stowed the cash in his pocket. He was saving for a Buffy tattoo on the other arm. Ink wasn't cheap.
Here, Iowa. When Maggie came awake, her arm was slung over Vic's waist and Vic's head was resting against her breastbone. She was the most gosh darn pretty woman that Maggie had ever been in bed with, and Maggie wanted to kiss her, but wouldn't. What Maggie really wanted to do was comb Vic's snarled, wind-blown hair, straighten it out, make it shine. She wanted to wash Vic's feet and rub them with oil. Maggie wished they had had more time together and a chance to talk about something besides Charlie Manx. Not that Maggie really wanted to talk. She wanted to listen. Maggie dreaded that moment in any conversation when it was her turn to open her big, dumb mouth. Maggie sensed she hadn't been asleep for long and had a pretty good idea she wouldn't be able to sleep again for hours. She untangled herself from Vic, smoothed her hair back from her face, and slipped away. It was time to spell, and now that Vic was asleep, Maggie could do what she needed to do to make the tiles behave. She lit a smoke, she lit a candle, arranged her fedora just so. Maggie set her Scrabble bag before her and loosed the golden thread. She considered the darkness within for a time, inhaling deeply on her cigarette. It was late, and she wanted to crush some oxy and have a snort, and she couldn't do it until she had done this one thing for Vic. She reached up and found the collar of her white muscle shirt and pulled it down, exposing her left breast. She removed her cigarette and shut her eyes and put it out. She held it against the top of her breast for a long time, grinding it into the tender flesh, letting out a thin, whining breath through her clenched teeth. She could smell herself burning. She flicked the extinguished cigarette away and bent over the desk, wrists pressed against its edge, blinking at tears. The pain in her breast was sharp and intense and wonderful. Sacred. Now, she thought. Now. Now. She had a brief window in which to use the tiles, to force sense out of gibberish, a minute or two at most. It seemed to her sometimes that this was the only fight that mattered, the struggle to take the world's chaos and make it mean something, to put it to words. She took a fistful of letters, dumped them before her, and began to sort. She moved tiles here and there. She had played this game for her entire adult life, and soon enough she had it. In a few minutes, the spelling was done. No trouble at all this time. When she saw she had it, she let out a long, satisfied breath, as if she had just set down a great weight. She didn't have any idea what the message meant. It had an epigrammatic quality about it, seemed less like a fact, more like the closing line of a lullaby. But Maggie was sure she had it right. She always knew when she had it right. It was as sure and simple a thing as a key clicking into a lock and turning a bolt. Maybe Vic could glean some meaning from it. She would ask her when she was awake. She copied out the message from the great Scrabble bag of fate on a sheet of water-stained Here Public Library stationery. She read it over. It was good. She was conscious of an unfamiliar glow of satisfaction, was unused to being happy with herself. She collected her letters one at a time and returned them to the velvet bag. Her breast throbbed, nothing transcendent about the pain now. She reached for her cigarettes, not to burn herself again,
but just for a smoke. A boy walked through the children's library carrying a sparkler. She saw him through the clouded glass of the old fish tank, a black figure against the paler darkness of the room beyond. As he walked, he swung his right arm and the sparkler spit a hot copper spray, drew red lines in the gloom. He was there for only a moment and then moved out of sight, carrying his sputtering torch with him. Maggie leaned toward the fish tank to bang on the glass, scare the shit out of him and run him off, then remembered Vic and caught herself. Kids broke in to throw firecrackers and smoke cigarettes and cover the walls in graffiti, and she hated it. She had once come across a squad of teenagers down in the stacks, passing a J around a campfire made of old hardcovers, and she had turned into a crazy woman, chasing them out with a busted chair leg, aware that if the peeling wallpaper caught fire, she would lose her last best home. "Book burners!" she had screamed at them, and for once she had not stuttered at all. "Book burners! I'll cut off your balls and rape your women!" It was 5-1, but they had fled before her as if they'd seen a ghost. Sometimes she thought she was a ghost, that she had really died in the flood, died with the library, and just hadn't realized it yet. She had a last look at Vic, huddled on the couch, fist balled under her chin. This time Maggie couldn't help herself. The door was over there, close to the couch, and as Maggie went by, she paused and bent over and kissed her temple lightly. In sleep, one corner of Vic's mouth turned up in a wry smile. Maggie went looking for the boy in the shadows. She stepped out into what had once been the children's library and eased the door shut behind her. The carpet had been peeled up into mildewed strips and rolled over against the wall in a series of stinking bundles. The floor beneath was wet concrete. Half an enormous globe occupied one corner of the room. The northern hemisphere upended and filled with water and pigeon feathers, sides streaked with bird crap. America turned upside down and shit on. She noticed absentmindedly that she was still carrying her bag of Scrabble tiles, had forgotten to put them back in the desk. Dumb. She heard a sound not unlike butter sizzling in a pan, off somewhere to her right. Maggie started around the U-shaped walnut desk, where once she had signed out Coraline and the house with a clock in its walls and Harry Potter. As she approached the stone gallery that led back to the central building, she saw a leaping yellow glare. The boy stood at the far end of the gallery with his sparkler, a small, stocky, black figure, hood pulled up to hide his face. He stood staring, his sparkler pointed down at the floor, pouring sparks and smoke. In the other hand was a long silver can of something. She smelled wet paint. "Myself stop, can't I?" he said in a hoarse, strange voice and laughed. "What?" she said. "Kid, get out of here with that." He shook his head and turned and wandered away, this child of shadow, moving like a figure in a dream, lighting a path into some cavern of the unconscious. He swayed drunkenly, almost careening off one wall. He was drunk. Maggie could smell the beer from here. "Hey!" she said. He disappeared. Somewhere ahead she heard echoing laughter. In the remote gloom of the periodicals room, she saw a new light, the guttering, sullen glare of a fire. She began to run. She kicked syringes and bottles clattering across the concrete floor, ran past boarded-over windows. Someone, the kid possibly, had spray-painted a message in red on the wall to her right. "God burned alive, only devils now." The paint was still dripping, bright red, as if the walls were bleeding. She ran into the periodicals room, a space as big as a modest-sized chapel and with ceilings just as high. During the flood it had been a shallow sargasso, a scum of magazines covering the water, a swollen mass of National Geographics and New Yorkers. Now it was a big, bare cement chamber with dried, hardened newspapers stuck to floors and walls. Rotten piles of magazines drifted in the corners, some sleeping bags spread where bums had camped out, and a wire trash can boiling with greasy smoke. The drunk little bastard had dropped his sparkler in it on top of a mess of paperbacks and magazines. Green and orange sparks spit from somewhere deep inside the burning nest. Maggie saw a copy of Fahrenheit 451 shriveling and blackening. The boy considered her from the far side of the room, from within a dark, high stone archway. Hey, she screamed again. Hey, you little shit!
Late to its butt, can I as hard as fighting I'm,
he said, rocking from side to side.
Me follow, don't please, please, please.
Hey, she said, not listening, unable to listen.